That's true. Listen up. I know firsthand how limited a vessel medical insurance can be. This is why you need reliable medical coverage. More Dixon offers comprehensive global insurance tailored for yachts, covering everything from emergencies to routine checkups with flexible options and a single point of contact. More Dixon has been voted best health and medical insurance by captains and crew, including myself. Don't wait until the unexpected happens. Get covered today. Visit mdbl.im or email them at inquiries@mdbl.im for a free quote. Start this episode and conversation with you with a real story of a female crew member who contacted me about a year ago in regards of a sexual assault that happened to her on board by a crew member. And we followed protocol and all the procedures that are meant to be followed in cases like this. She contacted Port Authority. She filed a police report. We contacted the captain who basically came back and said, you know, how much money do you want to keep her silent? Then we contacted management. We contacted Flag State. We ended up trying to contact MLC and Nautilus International and Jackcrew Help and, you know, everybody and anyone that we could think of that we should contact in this case. And after 2 weeks of trauma and this person not being able to sleep, eat, basically everybody said, hey, sign the NDA that they're giving you, take the 3,000 euros and go home. So she spoke up about the abuse. The retaliation was that she lost her job and she was, you know, intended to keep silent. And the perpetrator was kept on board. So these are stories that are horrendous, but also more common than not in the industry, in the maritime industry. So my question is, you know, we have all these guidelines set by the organizations of the maritime industry, but it doesn't seem like anybody really follows them or anybody is held accountable to follow them. It just seems that it's kind of up to the social responsibility of each individual and company to potentially use the guidelines and follow them and do the right thing. So as a lawyer, when you hear this, what are your thoughts?
Unfortunately, those situations happen a lot. And it's disturbing. It's unacceptable. So I personally think that we need more legislation, you know, passage of laws. But I, most importantly, I think that we need litigation, because once you hire an attorney and you litigate these things, you get rid of that culture that tends to sweep these things under the rug. The things that you mentioned, oh, the NDA, here's 3,000 euros, and now nobody talks about it as if it never happened. We bury our heads in the sand. So that's why litigation is so important, because you bring all these things to light. So you file papers where all of this is put in like black and white, all these horrible things that are happening, the assault, the cover-up following the assault, the attempt to silence these victims and survivors after the assault. So it's just a chain of bad things that are happening. And then the reaction to just silence everyone, that's unacceptable, because then what happens? We just have a vicious cycle and this scourge in the industry continues and we never see an end to it. So what can we do? I definitely recommend that yacht crew do inform Port State Control and do inform the authorities. You know, in your situation, you said that this woman in France, you know, filed a police report. She went to the police. So definitely notify the authorities. But when you don't get any relief or any response from them, by all means, contact a lawyer. Contact a lawyer. And the lawyer will let you know what your legal rights are. And sometimes those NDAs are not going to be enforceable. They're just intimidation tactics to continue to try to silence these women or these victims. And if you get an attorney to advise you about, like, I mean, an NDA is not going to be enforceable anyway. So who cares? Don't let that silence you. But if people don't know that that you can fight the enforceability of an NDA in certain situations, they just accept it. And then this scourge continues. So I think that litigation, hiring lawyers to, you know, put these things out there when sexual assault happens or sexual harassment or an unsafe condition or somebody was working on a yacht for 6 months and not getting paid or, you know, whatever the situation is, we shouldn't be silent about it and, oh, just hope that it's going to go away, because it's not. So with litigation, you bring these things out into the open, people start talking about it, you raise an awareness, and raising awareness sometimes leads to legislation and so the litigation and the legislation, in my mind, can lead to change.
What are the legal rights that seafarers have, regardless of tonnage, flag state, vessel type, meaning private or commercial, or crew nationality? Like, is there any basic guide of, like, these are basic rights that everybody, no matter what, have, or that's not how it works?
No, there are absolutely basic rights that these are seafarers' rights, regardless of vessel tonnage or certainly the nationality of the seafarer. That doesn't matter. Every crew member is entitled to a reasonably safe workplace. That's yacht safety. That's vessel safety. That's a reasonably safe workplace. Does it have?
Can I ask a question about the safety? Sure. Does that include psychological safety and, like, you know, like a place where there's no bullying, harassment, assault, like all that stuff? Is that part of it, or just that environment that is not, you know, the person, the individual?
No, great point. No, it's both. It's both. So as a crew member, yacht crew or any type of vessel, as a crew member on a vessel, you're entitled to a reasonably safe workplace. So that means, like, the vessel's gear and equipment has to be in pretty good shape. It can't be in disrepair. It has to be fit for whatever the purpose is. You know, if it's a ladder, it has to be fit for you to go up and down that ladder and so on and so forth. But you're also entitled to a workplace to be free of sexual assault and sexual harassment and free from bullying or discrimination and physical assault. Absolutely. And the reasonable safety also goes to, like, the crew. If there's a dangerous crew member on board, well, that crew member should not be on board, because that crew member is messing up that reasonably safe workplace that all the crew members are entitled to. You see what I mean? So you're, as a crew member, you're entitled to a seaworthy vessel. A vessel can be seaworthy, or a vessel can be unseaworthy, as we said, the equipment, but it could also be unseaworthy because there aren't enough crew members, you know? So the vessel is, like, short-staffed, undermanned. I don't like to say undermanned. It's a very sexist term, but, you know, so the vessel doesn't have enough crew members for the mission of the vessel. And then, so what happens? Everybody is working longer hours. They're not getting adequate hours of rest. The vessel is short-staffed and people are tired, exhausted, and also in a hurry. And that combination of factors renders the vessel unsafe. It leads to incidents. You know, we read about it all the time. So first and foremost, every crew member is entitled to a reasonably safe workplace. They are also entitled to room and board. You know, you're living on the vessel. The vessel has to be habitable. It doesn't have to be a five-star hotel, but it has to be a habitable environment for the crew member to live in. And you're entitled to, you know, room and board. So that means also, you know, you're adequate food, 3 meals per day, and you're also entitled to medical care and treatment. So that's very important. Crew members are entitled to medical care if they're injured during their contract, if they're injured during their service to the vessel. And it doesn't matter if the crew member was negligent, or if the owner of the vessel was negligent, or if the or if the employer was not negligent. None of that matters. If you're a crew member and you're injured during your employment contract, you're entitled to medical care. No questions asked. It's an automatic duty. That's extremely important. You know, it could, you're even entitled to medical care. Suppose something happens while you're ashore, on shore leave. So the injury doesn't even have to happen while you're on duty.
When it comes to bullying, when it comes to harassment, when does it become criminal harassment? Because what I have what I understand and what I have heard is that a lot of the time, these are not crimes. So I guess you cannot litigate. You cannot go to court because of it. So when does it become something that you can then potentially do something about it?
Okay, yeah. So this is a very hot topic and also a complicated issue. I'm not a criminal attorney, so I'm not going to give criminal advice. And, you know, and every country is different on whatever their criminal laws and their criminal statutes identify as being a crime or not being a crime. But just because you don't criminally prosecute a crime doesn't mean that you don't have a civil remedy. Like, so you can be in a situation where, you know, unfortunately you're a victim of assault and you contact law enforcement, you contact the police, and the police say, well, you don't have a case. We're not going to do anything. Sorry, we can't help you. Get out of here. Have a nice life. That's discouraging that they're not going to take any criminal action against the assailant. But it doesn't mean that you don't have a cause of action for civil assault. And so those are the cases that I handle. I don't handle criminal cases. Like in the United States, it would be the state that pursues criminal action against an individual. And then what happens is the state tries to put that person in jail and, you know, serve prison time for the crime that they committed after they prove all the elements beyond a reasonable doubt. I don't do that. I don't work for the government. I'm not looking to arrest people. So my job is as a civil attorney. I help these victims and survivors and these champions for change. I help them get civil remedy, civil causes of action against the assailant. And if it happens in the workplace, because I'm a seafarer attorney, then I go after the company or the employer. That's why the employer is so important. I go after the employer because if the situation was such that the environment was ripe, that this was going to happen, and the company knows about this problem, and the company doesn't do anything about it, and the company sweeps it under the rug, and the company covers it up, then we can go after the company and say, look, the company knew that this was a problem, or they should have known if they were taking reasonable care to guarantee this reasonably safe workplace, they wouldn't have allowed this to happen. And so then that assault victim, the injured party, has a civil case against the employer, as well as the assaulter, or the assailant, or, you know, whatever you want to call them. So,
and can you have both, like, civil and crime litigation at the same time?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You can. But remember, the criminal litigation, it's not. So in my civil practice, I practice civil law. Maritime law is civil law. And I represent crew members. So in our situation, the case will be, you know, my crew member versus the employer or the vessel or the company or whatever the case may be. So it's, you know, Jane Smith versus ABC company and the assailant. In a criminal matter, it's going to be like the state of Florida versus the person who committed the crime, not against the vessel, not against the employer. And the goal is different. So the goal of the criminal matter is to put that person in jail so that person doesn't continue to commit those, you know, assaults or trafficking or, you know, whatever the case may be. I don't do that in my practice. I don't work for the government, so I'm not prosecuting crimes. I'm a private civil lawyer, and I represent crew members who have been injured or assaulted or they haven't been paid or whatever. They have an issue with their employer, or they have an issue with the vessel, or they have an issue with the company. And then I represent, the case will be that injured person's name versus either the employer or the vessel or both.
So for those who are not familiar about Yacru Help, and so how is it different from any other helpline that's out there?
Yeah, so as you mentioned in the introduction, which was a great introduction, by the way, Yacru Help is a free, confidential and multilingual helpline, which is designed specially for yacht crew. And it's available 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. And it's run by a charity, which is a charity based in London with HQ in London, but with offices and people all over the world now. So that's the International Seafarers Welfare and Assistance Network. Doesn't necessarily roll very easily off the tongue. So we tend to call ourselves ICEONE, which people out there may not have heard of, but ICEONE for short. We're a charity working to ensure that seafarers and their families have support and resources to respond to the challenges of life at sea, because as we know, it's a pretty special place to work and it has some pretty special challenges as well. From my point of view personally, I absolutely loved working in the yachting industry. I had some amazing experiences, met some fabulous people, but also came across quite a few difficult situations, sometimes very challenging, both emotionally, physically, sometimes financially as well. There are all kinds of questions around yacht crew welfare, which are now starting to be addressed within the industry, which is a great thing to see. So just to give you a little bit of background as well about how Yacht Crew Help came to be, Yacht Crew Help, well, actually ICEONE has run a helpline for many years called Seafarer Help, which is exactly the same principle. It's a confidential 24-hour helpline that anyone who is a seafarer or who is related to a seafarer, who is the family of a seafarer or a crew member, can contact for any kind of issues, big or small. And in 2018, a piece of research was carried out by ICEONE with some partner organizations as well, looking at the key welfare issues that were being identified by yacht crew, specifically by yacht crew. And it was actually found that not very many yacht crew were contacting Seafarer Help as a helpline. And as part of this research, some very interesting numbers came out of that research in terms of the kind of issues that yacht crew were facing. But it also came out that yacht crew simply weren't identifying themselves as seafarers and therefore not using a service that was called Seafarer Help, which was part of the reason why Yacht Crew Help in itself was created, specifically for yacht crew, addressing the issues that yacht crew face at work and at play and at home nowadays. So Yacht Crew Help was launched in 2020 to respond to some of these needs in the unique, sometimes wonderful, sometimes less wonderful world of yachting.
Thank you, Laura, for that information. So I'm kind of wondering, how is ICEONE using the data that you gather through the helpline to advocate for better working conditions for crew in the private sector?
Yeah, what we do at ICEONE is every contact, first of all, and the most important thing to know, if you're contacting the helpline, your contact to us is going to be 100% confidential. It will also be anonymous if you want it to be anonymous. You don't need to tell us your real name. You don't have to tell us the name of the boat you're working for, your management company, anything like that, if you don't want to. You can share as much or as little as you wish. But what we do on the helpline is we gather some data about the types of issues that are raised to us, and we identify trends in that data. To say, for example, that, you know, over the space of 12 months, perhaps we see across the helpline an increase in a particular issue being raised to us. And then what we do on the Welfare of Yacht Crew project is we take that data and those insights and those things that yacht crew are telling us that they are facing, and we use them to develop educational resources, to develop programs and campaigns around those issues to start to address them within the industry. And we look for partners within the industry who are experts in those areas or who are working in those areas and who want to improve their own practices as well. and we collaborate with them on those projects.
I was the only female with 200 men in a galley. It was my first boat and my first ever physical experience with sexual harassment was actually on that boat. And that happened with somebody who was my senior chef. They'd walked in behind me into the walk-in fridges that you have, and he groped me, felt me up, and he threatened me. And he basically said to me that if I wanted to make my life easier, I had to sleep with him and do whatever he wanted. And that was, for me, that was just a no-go. So I went straight to the executive chef, and I, you know, I eventually left the ship because I was like, no, and I tried to get him blacklisted. So I took action straight away.
And when you took action and you spoke, did they support you?
Not a lot of support at all, because he'd been with the company for a very long time. He was in a senior position. So it was easier to sort of get rid of me because I was the noise, right? And I was trying to voice something up. So there was no, back in the day, there was no sort of speak up guardian. There was nobody that you could, you know, there was no crew welfare on board. So besides the purser's office or your executive chef or your upline, there was nobody that you could really speak to. So it was very scary, one. Two, it was like, I felt so uncomfortable every time I went into the galley, you know, because I kept having these, he would stare at me, you'd have, you know, because the environment was just very uncomfortable. It became so uncomfortable to the point that I asked to leave. I couldn't take it. It wasn't good.
So this is on a cruise ship where there's human resources, where's the DPA, there's all these things that are available that usually, in sadly, most boats in the yachting sector do not have this available because sometimes, you know, the captain is the management, the HR, everything, right? Like, so even when you had all this, you still didn't get the support that you should have gotten.
No.
Where do you think where's the missing gap? What's still missing? Even when you have all this, you know, DPA and management and HR and purser, what's missing there?
The personal element of actually listening to what people are going through. That personal element of she's a woman, she's in this space, safety, so you know, empathy is number one. The empathy, the compassion towards actually listening to what someone's going through. For them, it's, you see, because in the kitchens, it's about banter, isn't it? It's jokes. There's those innuendos that happen in hospitality, especially in the kitchens. It's very sexual. It's very, you know, a lot of, It depends. You have to see where it depends on the person as well. But there's a lot of that happens. But when it starts, the touching and the groping and the, you know, when it's in your personal space, it's not acceptable.
I think the reality is, and I think you mentioned that, you know, the banter, because we see this often in specifically in the yachting industry, there's a lot of banter. Yeah. There's so many different cultures. Some people 100%. Tend to banter more, others don't. But what I do want to make it very clear to everybody who's listening is that if the comment that is being done towards you, because sometimes words is not even like an actual harassment of a touch, right?
Nice.
A physical touch. Even if the whatever they're telling you, if you're not welcoming that, if you're not okay with that, if you're not comfortable with that, that is harassment, you know? Because a lot of time we say, oh, well, you know, is banter. Yeah. But are you okay with the banter? Because if you're not, then you are being harassed in a way, right? Like you don't have to take it if you're uncomfortable with it. And I think that's
absolutely,
like, there's that fine line of like, oh, well, they didn't mean it that way. I'm like, yeah, but it doesn't matter. It's a professional environment. And if there's, if the person doesn't feel comfortable, you should be able to say, hey, I'm sorry. I didn't mean it that way. Let's, you know, regroup and move forward in a professional way. But that doesn't tend to happen. Yeah. People tend to just not say anything, or even when they do speak up, because recently happened with a girl that I was supporting, a stewardess, she said to me, you know, they're making, the owner's making these comments about my sexy hands because she was a masseuse and she didn't feel comfortable. So I said, you know, let's talk about it. Let's talk with the owner, with the captain, everybody. She set boundaries, and then they basically shamed her by then now making comments of, now I cannot make a comment about your sexy hands. So now you're shaming the person. You're putting the person in the spot. So you're even harassing the person even further. You know? So, and then, you know, the people kept telling me, oh, but that's just banter. They didn't mean it in a wrong way. So it does not matter. It's a professional environment. they don't know each other. They don't have a personal relationship, you know? No. So it's such a, it seems to be a fine line, but it really isn't. It's pretty white and black, you know, to an extent.
Yeah, I think that understanding what constitutes harassment, right? So you've got verbal, you've got your insults, sexual comments, jokes. Then you've got nonverbal, your staring, gestures, mm-hmm. following, messages. Then you've got your psychological, so gaslighting, manipulation, undermining your confidence. This is a big one on both. Yeah. That's what they do to you. That happened to me a lot. Then the sexual side, the unwanted touching and the coercion of, you know, it's just what happens on boats, isn't it? And people have just left it. They said, oh, that's just what happens. But they don't realize how serious that is and how insecure it makes you feel. It breaks your confidence. You feel very vulnerable.
What is perimenopause and what's the difference between perimenopause and menopause for those who maybe is the first time they even heard the word perimenopause?
Yes, that actually is very common. A lot of women don't even know what it is, although in the last few years, it has become more mainstream. So menopause is essentially when you are no, it's the cessation of periods. You're no longer getting a menstrual cycle. Your ovaries have greatly slowed down production of your sex hormones, estrogen, progesterone, and testosterone. So perimenopause is the period of time before that, but it can, it essentially can start in your 30s, but some women can experience symptoms a year before menopause or up to 10 or more years before menopause.
Yeah, I mean, it's so, when I learned this, because obviously, I mean, not obviously, but for those who know me in the industry, I'm all about cyclical living and teaching people how to take menstrual rest. And I've been doing this like all through my 30s. But even though I was so educated in the menstrual aspect of my life, let's call it the fertility phase of my life, I literally was like, okay, there's fertility and then there's menopause. I, for some reason, forgot about the middle of that journey, which is so important, which obviously I'm in the middle of it. And it kind of caught me by surprise. But now that I'm educated through you and through other sources, and I'm getting the support I need, I'm realizing actually I'm 40, but this didn't start at 40. It actually started when I was 36.
I mean, you said something earlier about how you're like, how did I not know about this time frame? And it's not that, it's not your fault. We are not taught this and doctors are not taught this, which we can speak to later. But that time frame is a very huge transformation. We'll say that. It's a nice way of putting it for women after fertility. Right. So doctors are really knowledgeable about fertility, those years where you're able to get pregnant. But there's this major gap in medicine where women are not getting the support they need, which is obviously why we're here and talking about this today.
Exactly. So before we get into all the details that you're going to give us, I want to share a story from a chief stew who wanted to be on the show, but she's working. So she sent me her story. So I'm just going to read it because I want to use her words. So she said, her name is Camila. And she said, in 2017, at the age of 40, I started to notice changes in my body. At the time, I didn't think much of it, just migraines, tiredness, and irregular periods. And by the way, I don't have irregular periods. That's what I never thought I was going through, you know, what I'm going through. Like many women, I chalked it up to stress and work. But by 2021, things escalated. I began experiencing loss of concentration, hot flashes, anxiety, massive mood swings, waking up in the middle of the night, and low libido. Being married, I was determined to address the low libido, but every doctor I visited insisted I was fine. My tests came back normal, and I was told repeatedly that I was too young to be experiencing menopause. To make things worse, life threw even more challenges my way. I lost my job, went through a divorce, and was under immense stress. I wasn't eating well and blamed everything I was feeling on my circumstances. I didn't realize that my hormones were the real culprit. At work, the symptoms took a heavy toll. My thyroid became unbalanced, my concentration suffered, and I struggled to pay attention to the little details that are critical in my role as a chief stew. Forgetting things, procrastinating, and missing deadlines became my new normal, completely out of character for someone known to be sharp and responsible. I was constantly stressed, angry, and irritable, which affected my relationship with the crew. Instead of fostering teamwork, I became disconnected from those around me. I would often break down crying or feel agitated for no reason. I felt like I was losing control of myself, and I yet couldn't understand why. Before my divorce and job loss, I thought I had everything I wanted. So why was I feeling so miserable? I had no answers, and it was a dark, confusing time. After 3 years of struggling without any support, I finally started educating myself and sought the help I needed. Hormone replacement therapy was a game changer. With time, I learned how to support my body through this transition, and life became more manageable. Looking back, I wish I'd been more educated about this phase of life. I also wish I had a doctor who truly listened to me. It wasn't until I opened up to my sister about what I was going through that I learned she had gone through menopause at 42. And my mom had experienced it in her late 40s. The lack of conversation, even within my own family, was startling. This needs to change. Women need to talk about this more, and workplaces, especially in high-pressure environments like yachting, need to provide better support. I believe having access to telehealth doctors specializing in women's health will be a huge step forward. Counselors training hormonal health could also help crew members recognize what's happening and guide them to the right resources. Perimenopause is not just a personal journey. It affects every aspect of your life, including your ability to perform at work and connect with others. My 7-year journey, especially those 3 first years that were unsupported, was a nightmare, and I wouldn't wish on anyone. By raising awareness and normalizing these conversations, we can create a world where women no longer have to navigate this transition in silence. And that's Camila's words. Wow. So, yeah. So that's a story. Hopefully, some of you can relate. I mean, you cannot relate yet. I can tell you, you will. Because if you're a woman and you live long enough, we're all going to go through this. But suffering is an option.
I think there is this terrible stigma. And that's one of my things that I fight against most, is trying to remove the stigma from mental health. Because it's, and I'm not the only one trying to do that, but it's still there and people are still frightened. You know, they're worried about going to their captain saying, can I see my therapist, because, or a therapist, because they think the captain's going to think, oh, I'm not fit for my job. Well, I think that, but that is what is still associated with it, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting what you said about your journey of becoming a psychotherapist and having to take therapy yourself, and you even resisting it at the beginning, but obviously it was like a demand, so you have to, a requirement, so you have to do it. And then it gave you the perspective of like, hey, you know what, like, this is not just for those who need or believe that need the help, or that we can see that they need the help, but this is really for everybody. Because I think that, you know, it's all about prevention. And when we see a counselor, a therapist, when we're feeling our best, I think that's when we really need to go to the therapist. It's when we feel our best. Because when we feel our best, then we're more open to dive deeper into our self-development and be more curious about what can I learn about me. I think really if we start to looking at therapy and counseling as a self-development tool and not as something, there's something wrong and this is what's going to fix me, I think that really might take away that, start to take away the stigma around it. And obviously conversations from the captain and within the crew of like, hey, we should, you know, we should be self-developing ourselves through therapies and counseling. But yeah, it's, you know, I have been on the both sides of the coin where I have gotten therapy because I was not doing well. Like I was in depression, suicidal ideation. And then after that, I was like, no, I need to continue to therapy to not get there. Because this is the way to prevent it.
I think that what just came to me this then was that, you know, not my generation, but your generation and even people younger than you spend more time and more effort and more money probably as well on staying fit, looking after themselves, looking to the future, looking to, you know, live longer. And in fact, I know that certainly for a while, and I don't know if it still is the case, but there was a time I was aware in the last 3 or 4 years where people would happily say they were going to AA meetings, you know, and it was like a badge of honor to say, oh, I'm off to see my, you know, my AA group. And I guess what would be really good is if we got to the point where people were just happy to say, I'm off to see my therapist. And it's cool. It's not.
And I do have to say that is not the majority, but there's a lot of people out there that I talk, you know, daily with crew who are happy to say, actually, yeah, this is how I take care of my mental health. Because what I see, what I hear a lot when I ask on interviews with crew and I say, how do you take care of your mental health? First, they have to think about it. And when they think about it, they always tell me, I read books or I exercise physically, which is true. Exercising and taking time to just be is going to benefit your mental health. But like you said, your brain is a muscle and it also does need a different stimulation that just running is not going to give you. Absolutely. So having a resource like a therapy, a counseling session is going to be that extra effort, that extra practice that you're going to give to your brain in order to really maintain your mental health. Because the same way we maintain our bodies, we do have to maintain our mental health.
I don't think the management companies see value in emotional intelligence or mental fitness. I don't think they see true financial value in ocean conservation. And that's sad for me. I think a budget line item should be continuing education, including mental fitness or mental health. And it should be environmental sustainability. But back to mental health or mental fitness, I think it's important that you just keep being persistent in your approach to showing the return on investment in terms of longevity or relationships on board. The positive feel that the owners get when they walk on board, they all want that. They want the crew unity. They all talk about it. All the brokers love the crew get on really well. Some of the best comments I've got is that the junior deckhand is happy when they greet him. Now, to get that happy junior deck crew, because they've got a tough job, you have to invest in resources and training, like Seize the Mind, like the crew coach, like iSwan. They all do these courses, which I think are fantastic. But you have to convince the owner and management companies that this is just like an STCW. This is training your crew to get mentally prepared for the challenges they're going to face so they succeed a season or 2 years or whatever it is. So my answer is not enough is being done. It's a horrible environment still to work in terms of the tools that the crew get given. It should be a requirement onboarding to do a mental health check or once a year, once every 6 months from an external factor that's not related to the management company, the owner or the vessel, because that's my biggest takeaway is third-party oversight must happen. That comes through mental awareness and different resources.
No, I agree with you. And I think, the ROI, the return of investment, I think there's enough data as of today, or management or captains or whoever is managing the vessel or even recruiting for the principal to showcase, hey, this is what's actually happening and this is how we can mitigate it and this is how we can make it better.
So it's a return on investment, but it's also what I call it should be a fixed cost, just like fuel, just like dockage, just like these are fixed costs. And it's investing in your crew because your crew is one of the biggest expenses on the boat. So get yourself an insurance policy on your crew. That's my advice to captains going to owners. You've got insurance on the boat. What's your insurance on the crew? You're paying a little bit medically, but you're not paying anything emotionally or mentally or financially. So invest in your crew and it'll pay back.
If your brand belongs in the heart of the yachting world, this is where it happens. Yachting International Radio reaches over 1 million yachting professionals and enthusiasts every month with 77 million impressions, 220,000 social followers, and 74,000 podcast subscribers. Our hosts are insiders, crew, captains, CEOs, trusted voices shaping the industry. This is targeted, high-impact advertising in a luxury niche. Visit yachtinginternationalradio.com/advertise. Your audience is already listening.